Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Hello today to a Marine battalion based in Ohio. The U.S. military says that 14 Marines killed by a roadside bomb today in western Iraq were members of the same battalion that lost six Marine snipers on Monday. They were all members of the 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines, based in the Cleveland suburb of Brook Park. Today's attack was one of the deadliest single attacks in Iraq against American forces. At a Pentagon briefing, a top-ranking U.S. military officer attributed the recent rash of American deaths in Iraq to a very lethal and, unfortunately, adaptable enemy in the war-torn country. Well, joining us on the line now is Isolde Zirk from Columbus, Ohio. Her son, Guy Zirk, is a platoon sergeant in that 3rd Battalion. He is serving in Iraq, and she heads a support group for Marine families. Isolde, 14 more Marines killed today from that same Ohio-based battalion, the same as the one that lost six Marines 2 days ago. Your thoughts as you hear this news?
It's really bad, bad news to get 14 more Marines in our unit. And at this point in time, of course, not much is known.
It is so new, but I'm imagining that word spreads. Have people been calling people? How does it resonate?
I'm sure by the time I get home to the home from the office that I will have a lot of phone calls. I will have a lot of emails. I will be very busy again tonight and try to just keep the families calm. Not that I have any information, because I don't. The family certainly will know long before I do. But at least I can keep the families calm.
Yeah. We have four names from Monday's tragedy when several snipers on patrol were ambushed, six of them killed. Four names from Ohio, one from North Royalton, from Willoughby, from Talmadge, from Toronto, Ohio.
Correct.
And we have recently reported on losses in your son's company. Your son is in Lima Company. They suffered several casualties in May. And then on the 28th of July, two more casualties from your son's Lima Company. Your people must be reeling.
Our Marines are pretty, my son is pretty shaken up. And the devastation, of course, in having remembrance services is very hard on the Marines, because they live in such close quarters. They're really brothers. Okay, and it hits you hard, no matter who gets hurt.
Yeah. And now, you know, 20 more services to look forward to, 20 more young Marines from Ohio. And it does seem as if it's more than any number from other areas that we're hearing about. I mean, your thoughts on why Ohio?
Because our unit, 325, happens to be in an area in western Iraq that is now the hot place with insurgents, et cetera, that we are trying to clear. If you remember a few years back when we fought Fallujah, I mean, we weren't there. It was another Marine outfit, the heavy losses that they took. So this is, you know, I mean, this is where we need to clean the area, and that's where we are located. So it may seem that it's always Ohio, but we are just in a bad spot.
Isolde, I have not asked you the obvious. Have you heard from your son? Are you worried that your son?
No, I have not heard from my son. I have not. But that's okay. I need to be strong.
Well, we wish you all the best.
Thank you. Thank you. And I heard for every one of the Marines that was lost today and yesterday and throughout the entire deployment, not only of Lima 325, but of all our men and women in the service that have fought for our freedom so we can take showers and have the right to say what we want to say. And so I'm just ache for all of them. As a mother, obviously there are days that you don't feel so good.
Yeah, and this is one of them. Isolde, sir, can I ask, where are you from originally?
Originally, I was born and raised and educated in Germany and came over to this country as a single young woman because I always wanted to come to America. Always felt this is the best country in the world. And I wanted to live here, so that's how I came to the United States, and I'm glad I did.
Isolde Sirk. She's the mother of Platoon Sergeant Guy Zirk, currently serving in Iraq. She has a support group for Marine families in the Columbus, Ohio area. They are waiting to hear the names of the now 14 more Marines killed today in Iraq, 6 killed on Monday, all from the same company in Ohio. Isolde, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Investigators are following an electronic trail left by the London bombing suspects, and it may take them in a familiar direction, Saudi Arabia. British authorities are tracking a pattern of communication between London and Saudi Arabia. And joining us now from Washington is Josh Meyer. He covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times and visited Riyadh earlier this year for a counterterrorism conference. We want to hear about both. Josh, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And can you tell us a little bit about this current state of the London bombing investigation, especially as it points to Saudi Arabia?
Well, the London bombings on July 7th and the subsequent bombing are the biggest investigation, apparently, criminal investigation in British history. And all signs initially pointed to Pakistan in terms of connections to alleged al-Qaeda suspects there. But now, increasingly, investigators are looking at Saudi Arabia. They found a connection and a series of phone calls, text messages, emails between leaders of the al-Qaeda network in Saudi Arabia and unknown militants in Britain that date back as early as February of this year.
You know, the London Times, for instance, is reporting that police are investigating these cell phone contacts, including contacts that suspect Isaac Hamni, who's also known as Osman Hussein, might have had. He was reported to have made a phone call directly to Saudi Arabia right before he was captured in Rome.
Right. It's pretty amazing in terms of following the technological trail of these guys, especially Hamdi. He was apparently on a train fleeing Britain and heading to Rome, and they were able to trace him from SIM chips in his cell phone. And even though he was trying to get rid of the evidence, they were able to trace phone calls to Saudi Arabia, apparently in which he was seeking the names of people who might be able to provide him with shelter.
Well, Josh, officials are saying that they are convinced that there is a ringleader. And that brings to mind a question we've had about Osman Hussein, again, the suspect who was captured in Rome. He reportedly said, and it was reported in a Rome newspaper, that the failed July 21st attacks that he was involved in were just a reaction to the July 7th attacks, that they were angry about the way Muslims had been treated following the first attacks. And from what you know about terrorism, doesn't that strain credulity just a little bit, that in the space of 2 weeks, he'd be able to get the same bomb-making material — officials believe that both sets of bombs use the same material — make the bombs in the exact way the first bombs were made, carry out an attack in just 2 weeks? Doesn't that seem as if it's not possible that it was just a reaction?
It does screen credulity, Robin, especially since TATP, which is the chemical that's used in this, is a very volatile and complicated chemical to make explosives with. It's the same chemical Richard Reed used in the shoe bomb aboard a flight towards the United States right after 9/11. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. You know, he may be a well-trained al-Qaeda operative who is trained in the art of subterfuge and telling authorities one thing so that they don't look into another. He may be telling the truth. Nobody really knows. All I can say is that Scotland Yard is working very closely with the United States, and they both have a lot of resources on this, both electronic eavesdropping, people on the ground, and so forth. So they're desperately trying to pull at the threads of this and find out, you know, what really is happening, whether there is a foreign or somebody still in Britain who's a senior operative who's calling the shots, or whether it was more of an indigenous copycat operation on the second set of attacks, or what is happening.
Well, let's go back to these reports of cell phone calls between Saudi Arabia and Britain. When were they reported to have been made? Who were they made to?
Well, they were reported to have been made at least between February, ironically, which is when the counterterrorism conference was happening, at which representatives from 55 countries were in Riyadh discussing global terrorism, and at least May. So that's a pretty significant period of time. Authorities are not saying much about who the people were on either end of the conversations, but one of the people that whose name has come up is Abdul Karim Majadi, who's a Moroccan believed to be the head of the al-Qaeda network in the Persian Gulf. And to some of his associates. And Majadi was killed in April by security forces in Saudi Arabia. but there's other Moroccans in and out of Saudi Arabia that have been linked to this. Saudi Arabia just appears to still be a base of operations for many different al-Qaeda cells, operating both locally and internationally.
Well, you answered one question we had. We were wondering if there were cell phone contacts between someone in Britain and al-Qaeda leaders in Saudi Arabia, why couldn't they get the al-Qaeda leaders in Saudi Arabia? And you're saying that at least one has been killed.
They've actually killed quite a few of them. When I was in Riyadh in February, there was a lot of documentation floating around the conference about what various countries were doing to fight counterterrorism. And the Saudis, I'm not sure if they released it. I obtained from the Saudi from the conference an internal report by the Saudi government that goes into great detail about all of the different attacks and all the different arrests and the shootouts with suspects in it. And it was written in order to give the impression that they're getting the problem under control. I happen to read it as more of the opposite, that there were so many shootouts and so many arrests all around Saudi Arabia that it does appear to be quite an extensive problem there still.
Well, I was going to ask, how strong do you think the al-Qaeda presence in Saudi Arabia is?
I think it's quite strong, and I think that they're very concerned about it. I know the U.S. authorities are extremely concerned about it now that King Fahd has passed away finally and Crown Prince Abdullah is taking over as king. I think they're hoping to solidify their relationships even more with the Saudi government and the royal family and work more closely with us. But the Saudi government, after years of resistance, according to authorities, is now fully on board in terms of fighting these guys. They realize it's a death struggle and that it's either al-Qaeda or them that's going to prevail. So they're bringing all their significant resources to bear on the problem. Nevertheless, years and years of allowing these guys to operate within the kingdom has given al-Qaeda a very extensive network within the kingdom.
Yeah. One troubling allegation is that cash was transferred from Saudi Arabia to Britain. That's another one of the communications that's being followed.
Right.
Saudis among al-Qaeda's earliest financial backers. So this has got to be an alarming revelation if it's true.
The very prominent Saudi businessmen and social figures have always been the cornerstone of al-Qaeda financing from the very beginning. There was a group called the Golden Chain, which was at least a dozen of these guys. So, yes, money helping al-Qaeda has always been streaming out of Saudi Arabia, whether or not it's increasing, decreasing, if it's just for particular attacks or for just general activity, nobody really can say. But it doesn't take a lot of money to pull off of something like the London attack.
And by the way, the money transfers in the London investigation allegedly used the Hawala system
right.
to move those monies. What is that again?
Well, it's an informal money transfer system that's been used for literally thousands of years in Arabic countries in which somebody pays money on one end and then somebody picks it up on the other end, and you sort of use an informal system of chits and secret numbers and so on, and it's almost impossible for authorities to trace it, especially if the Hawalas are not registered, and the ones that are trying to help terrorists obviously are the ones who don't seek to go out and register with governments that would like them to. So it's a very tough problem to get a handle on. I know one of the money transfer systems that's alleged in this case, Al-Barakat, has been at the top of the U.S. government's list of suspicious finance companies since right after 9/11.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He visited Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, earlier this year for a counterterrorism conference, and he's been commenting on the possible links between al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia and the London bombings. When we come back, well, where is Osama bin Laden in all of this? We'll get Josh's opinion. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Who covers terrorism for the LA Times. We've been talking about a possible Saudi connection to the recent London bombings. And Josh, let's listen first to Saudi Arabia's deputy ambassador to Washington. In a press conference this week, he was unequivocal.
Saudi Arabia will not stand for an evil cult using the Islamic faith as an excuse for mass violence.
And Joshua, we also heard from Prince Turki Al-Faisal this week. Now, he is currently the Saudi ambassador to Britain. Soon he's going to be ambassador to the U.S. He said Osama bin Laden is still directly commanding al-Qaeda operations. Do you think that's true? Is Osama bin Laden, in your view, still calling the shots?
Well, I personally would tend to doubt that Osama bin Laden is calling the shots in the London attacks. But I also know that Prince Turki is somebody who has known Osama bin Laden since they were kids growing up in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have probably the best intelligence on al-Qaeda of any government in the world. It's hard to tell, though, however, when somebody like Prince Turki says that bin Laden's calling the shots, whether it's because of specific intelligence they have or because they would like to think that it's being directed from somewhere outside the kingdom.
But we do have reports of some of the London bombers that one of them told friends he went to Saudi Arabia to train.
Right, right. It's a deep concern to U.S. officials that there are training camps around the world that continue to exist. I wrote a story a few weeks before the London bombings about how Pakistan was of extreme concern to U.S. authorities because they did appear to have a network of training camps that were around the country that were training militants much in the same way they had been in Afghanistan. And they believe the same thing is happening in Saudi Arabia and Indonesia and elsewhere around the world.
You mentioned something just now that pointed to how complicated Saudi internal relations are, that Ambassador Prince Turki had a relationship with Osama bin Laden at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Might he still, and might others in government in Saudi Arabia still?
Well, that's a very good question. I do know that when the United States and Pakistan were trying to negotiate with the Taliban to give up bin Laden, they sent Prince Turki to Riyadh. This is, I think, in 2000, to negotiate with the Taliban. It is, you know, widely known that the two certainly know each other. Prince Turki, however, is very well respected as a intelligence official. For years, you know, people like Prince Nayef, for instance, oversaw the charities that were raising funds, mm-hmm. you know, for allegedly for Islamic causes, and those were all, a lot of that money was going to al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that they're like having coffee or anything like that.
Mm. If the London bombings turn out to be an al-Qaeda operation, again, we mentioned that one of the suspects who was picked up in Rome made a phone call to Saudi Arabia right before he was picked up. One other suspect from an earlier bombing told friends that he was going to Saudi Arabia to train. These are just loose connections. But if it was ordered by bin Laden and executed with assistance from terrorists in Saudi Arabia, what happens then?
Well, you know, I think we need to find Osama bin Laden. And I think, you know, we need to find Ayman Zawahiri. I think there's a guy, Saif al-Adel, who was yet another number three in al-Qaeda, who is probably in Iran that we would need to find. But I think that the knowledgeable authorities that are running the show here think that that what's even more important than finding these guys is finding the operational commanders who exist around the world, people like Mejadi, the guy that was killed in Saudi Arabia. I think what they believe is that al-Qaeda was sort of like a baseball, Major League Baseball team in which it recognized good talent, brought them up through a farm system, and then gave them a lot of autonomy on their own so that they could go out and execute attacks without having to deal with a brain trust back in Afghanistan. And unfortunately for us, that tactic appears to have worked very well. Mm.
Josh Meyer, with your expertise in terrorism, and again, you attended this counterterrorism conference in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia recently. Do you think there's any chance that the bombers in London were completely homegrown?
Well, it depends on what you mean by homegrown. I mean, I think a lot of this is a matter of semantics.
I guess without any influence from an outside organization, without any funds or direction from a group like al-Qaeda.
I think no. I mean, I think that what the problem is that a lot of these people are radicalized and become, you know, militants, and then once they reach that stage, then they go on to further training and further indoctrination by people, whether they're al-Qaeda central or whether they're al-Qaeda sympathizers or just part of what some authorities now call the, you know, global Islamic, you know, radical fundamentalist front, I guess, is the best way to put it. I think it's a combination of both.
By the way, while we have you, what was that conference in Riyadh like? Again, it's in Saudi Arabia, where some people feel that terrorism has sprung forth from, and yet it's a country that's trying in some way to fight terrorism. Who was there? What was it like?
Well, it was a bit surreal. I mean, one of my favorite moments was when all of the delegates were moved from their hotel to the conference center with the press, and we were in a couple of buses, and I have never seen that kind of security in my life. And as another one of the delegates put it, you know, he was afraid that the buses were going to get blown up by a terrorist on the way to the conference, which mm-hmm. would have been a very embarrassing thing for the Saudis and unfortunate, obviously, for all of us on the bus. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a very, very real threat in Saudi Arabia that no matter what they do, that there's going to be more, you know, more attacks. And you know, they found many instances of huge caches of explosives in houses and so on. And what the conference was interesting for was that there were representatives from about 55 countries there, and they were all talking about how we need to fight terrorism. And one of the questions that didn't really come up during the whole conference was the Saudi government's role in either overlooking terrorism for many years or not fighting it now or allowing it to happen within their own country.
The elephant in the living room. Can the world trust that Saudi Arabia will eventually contain its terrorism problem? And if it doesn't, is there anything that anyone can do?
Well, those are two of the million-dollar questions, I would say. I think the U.S. government continues to work very closely with the Saudi authorities. There are some people within the Saudi government that they do trust, and they pin their hopes a lot on. In fact, there's a guy named Mohammed bin Faisal, who is essentially their John Ashcroft, who's a very young guy trained in the West, who really seems to understand what's at stake here, which is essentially the stake. What's at stake is the royal family and the future of Saudi Arabia. And they believe that people like Mohammed bin Faisal really are on their side fighting this. It's just a question of making sure that they allow us to help them and keeping them on message and reminding them that that they're under attack as well.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He recently attended a conference on counterterrorism in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. He's been speaking to us about the possible connections between the London bombings and Al-Qaeda cells in Saudi Arabia. Josh, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome, Rob.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, as we just heard, one of the London bombing suspects was tracked down by his cell phone. We'll look at how the government and even private companies can use your cell phone to track you down. Also, Fenway Park as the seat of a new religion for the Fenway faithful. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now.
What happened to it? Thank you, Mike.
That's astronaut Stephen Robinson talking with Mission Control in Houston today, just after he successfully made the first ever in-flight emergency repair to the space shuttle's underbelly. Robinson gently pulled two strips of insulating filler that were protruding from between some of Shuttle Discovery's delicate heat shield tiles. The entire walk, which included the scheduled installation of an equipment platform, took just under 6 hours. NASA's lead flight director Paul Hill proclaimed the mission a success.
When he pulled that first gap filler out and it came right out, as I was bragging to folks at Wood yesterday, I was absolutely relieved, and I think you could probably hear the sigh of relief throughout the building over there. And when he pulled the second one out, it was a huge relief, and it definitely felt like the rest is downhill from here.
Joining us is Dr. Jay Apt. He's a four-time shuttle astronaut. In 1991, along with another fellow astronaut, he performed the first successful emergency spacewalk in the space shuttle program. So, Dr. Apt, we're thrilled to have you here with us, and I'm imagining you were as relieved to see that second piece of filler pulled out so easily.
Robin, I think that that's a fair characterization of the way everybody felt. But, they had done a lot of simulations of this down at Mission Control in Houston, and I saw some of the video and the stills of that, and it looked like it was going to come out just fine.
Right.
And, of course, it did. The plan that Mission Control sent up was just great, and Steve did just a wonderful job executing it.
Well, we watched some of the pictures as well, but for those who didn't, tell us more about what happened. I mean, it looked as if in his spacesuit floating outside the shuttle on the arm of this sort of electronic arm, he seemed to be wielding a huge barbecue mitt, when he pulled these two pieces out. What was that on his hand?
Well, space has no air in it, and if you just went out there in your shirt sleeves, you'd be dead in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. What we have to wear is a pressure suit, much like a deep-sea diver, and part of that pressure suit is the glove. The glove is insulated to keep the air in and to keep the heat and cold out.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the easiest thing to work in. You feel just like a welder working a welding torch. You've got to be very, very careful. In addition, unlike the welder, you've got to work against the pressure in the suit. And so it's about a pound every time you move your index finger back and forth. You're fighting a pound's weight.
Hmm. And as I said, he's had this glove on, which also looked like a huge lobster claw. And he had to put together what looked like one finger and a thumb to pull back this piece of white filler. Amazing, actually, that he could do that.
Well, you've got actually a fair amount of dexterity. You learn over the years of training, and they trained for this flight for 4 years, exactly how to use the suit precisely to your advantage. We had a couple of years of training for my first flight where we did a couple of spacewalks, and we felt perfectly comfortable with everything. We had, as you mentioned in the introduction, an emergency. Didn't know what was wrong with this particular spacecraft we were asked to repair, and got underneath it and made it work pretty quickly. Mm. All of that was new, but it worked very well.
Well, you know best then, because you and, as you said, your crewmate Jerry Ross performed this unscheduled spacewalk to deploy an antenna. NASA officials refer to the mental fatigue for doing such a long spacewalk. Can you speak to that? Because I heard another astronaut say this morning that there's something that can happen where you can, he used the word detached, not literally, but to feel detached and to suddenly feel as if you're out in space.
You know, I never really did feel that. We were concentrating on our tasks quite a bit, and when we had a break while we were waiting for the ground to do something, we got a chance to look at the Earth, and boy, that'll hold your attention. I never did feel detached in any way.
Yeah, I guess he mentioned that there's almost a danger of suddenly feeling exactly what you're doing and feeling however many miles an hour, for instance, that you're traveling, and that's not always a great feeling.
I felt a sensation of speed only once, and that's when we saw Central America down over by the wing of the shuttle. And as we came down into South America or over South America, the great bulk of South America came on very suddenly. And that was a neat feeling. I thought that was just terrific.
Yeah, well, good, because that would have been bad if it weren't. As NASA says, it's downhill from here for the Discovery crew. I think he meant that in a positive way. I think he meant smooth sailing. But there is still apparently doubt about what pulling this gap filler out is really going to do. And apparently NASA is still evaluating a second problem, some insulating blanket material that's sticking.
There's no doubt about what pulling the gap filler out did. Let me correct
what
you said on that. These gap fillers are used only during ascent to keep the wind of ascent from getting under the tiles. They have no function in this area of the shuttle for entry at all.
Oh, good.
They could have caused some problems on entry, and that's now been corrected.
Oh, good, because people had questions here. If this was filler that was to keep the tiles from shimmying, you know, it's gone now. So you're saying that's not a problem.
It's designed in that area of the shuttle to prevent the ascent aerodynamic loads from getting between the shuttles and weakening their bond. Mm. It has no function at all on entry. Mm. Now, the second question, they are still evaluating. That's a blanket near one of the six cockpit windows, the side window, on the commander's side, the left side of the vehicle. And they're not at all worried about what it could do to the window. They're just wondering, well, if it comes detached, could it hit something on the shuttle? And they're not even sure it can come detached. It's not like a tile. It's part of a long blanket material. Mm. And so they're still looking at that, and they'll get the answer on that later today or early tomorrow.
Dr. Jay Abt, again, he flew on four space shuttle missions, and in 1991 he helped perform the first successful emergency spacewalk in the space shuttle program. So, Dr. Abt, one last question in the very few seconds we have. What do you think of all this new technology that provided, for instance, pictures for us? Stephen Robinson had a camera on his helmet.
We started using that in 1984 on the Solar Maximum repair mission on the 13th shuttle flight. The capability has been continuously upgraded since then, and it's just a wonderful capability. It helps the people inside the shuttle and helps the folks on the ground. Great piece of gear.
Yeah, in fact, because of all the cameras, they knew about the gap filler problems and other external problems, which they might not have known before.
I think that what they did getting ready for this flight is very good, and they know now a lot more about how this vehicle flies and where the interesting parts of the flight are and where they got to watch out and be careful.
Yeah, and again, we just have a few seconds, but everyone says that this is it for the shuttle program, but this has been a good day for the shuttle.
Well, let me correct you again. This is not it. The administrator of NASA has said repeatedly over the last few days that we're going to go ahead and fix the shuttle tank and get the shuttles back into space. They'll fly until the president's switchover date of the end of 2010, at which point there'll be a new vehicle to fly, but they are depending on the shuttles until the end of this decade.
Dr. Jay Abt, with your expertise, we thank you so much for being here with us, a former shuttle astronaut, also a distinguished service professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Dr. Abt, thank you again.
You're welcome, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. President Bush left Washington for his Crawford, Texas ranch on what is scheduled to be the longest presidential vacation in 36 years. The president is expected to spend 5 weeks at Crawford, and while his aides say the break will help him reconnect with the American people, Democrats say he leaves behind questions about top aide Karl Rove's role in the CIA leak case, as well as an ongoing war in Iraq. Mark Noller is White House correspondent for CBS. He's made an art form of tracking the president's travels. In fact, he's hunkered down in Crawford, keeping an eye on President Bush. Mark, welcome.
Thanks.
Well, now, the Washington Post says that you keep better records of President Bush's travel plans than the White House itself does. So tell us, how much vacation time does the president take?
Well, you know what? I'm not certain it's really fair to say the president takes much vacation time. He is moving his base of operations to his ranch for the month of August. He'll be here this visit 33 days. That's longer than any other stretch during his presidency, and I guess that's what they mean. But you know what? Whether a president is Democrat or Republican, the job goes with him wherever he is. Mr. Bush still gets daily national security briefings. He has got practically all of the communications capabilities at his ranch that he does at the White House. But it certainly is a change of pace from the White House. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly nothing in the Constitution that requires the president to be at the White House. He is president wherever he goes.
Well, but you'd have crunched some numbers.
Yeah.
49th trip to Crawford?
By my count, it is the 49th visit. He has spent all or part of 320 days at his ranch since taking office.
That's 20% of his presidency, I think you've calculated.
Almost a year. He has also gone to Camp David a lot. That is another way for him to get away from the White House. By my count, he has been to Camp David 93 times during his presidency, and that adds up to all or part of 294 days. So you add that to the 300 days that he's been at the ranch, and you've got over 500 days that he's away from the White House.
Yeah. And now President Clinton averaged 20 days per year vacation. President Reagan spent 335 days in Santa Barbara over his eight-year presidency. We understand that President Bush is about to overtake that number, and he has 3 years left in his presidency. But is this, you know, as you said, you know, is this criticism fair that it signals something about President Bush's leadership that he takes so much time off?
Well, once again, probably not. He is president wherever he goes, with the responsibilities, the problems, they go with him. And he can be back in Washington in 3 hours if he needs to be. And people have got to ask, do they want the president to get a little bit of a break, a little bit of a change of pace from the White House, or do they expect him to be in the White House 365 days a year for 8 years?
And by the way, we hear that President Bush clears brush when he's there. There's got to be a lot of brush. 5 weeks of clearing brush. I mean, what does he really go out there and clear the brush?
He really does. There's a lot of cedar wood on his ranch. There's a lot of prairie land, 1,600 acres. He takes great pride in tending to his ranch. He loves showing it off. When foreign leaders come, one of the first things Mr. Bush does is put them in his white pickup truck and drive them around the ranch, and he loves tending to it. During his first summer here, we saw him down in a gully with a power saw clearing brush, and he does it. And you're right, it might seem like there wouldn't be a stick of wood left, but there is.
Mark Noller, CBS White House correspondent, on the job in Crawford, Texas, as President Bush begins his 5-week summer vacation. Mark, thank you.
And you.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my bicycle.
Well, there's a good chance President Bush will also spend time in Crawford on his beloved bike, as will thousands of other Americans. This note, bike sales have spiked in the week since another Texan, Lance Armstrong, won his seventh and last Tour de France. Bike shops such as the Cycle Loft in Burlington, Massachusetts, are reporting a surge in sales with requests for the same bike that Lance rode to victory. So many requests that the Trek Bicycle Company, which signed a contract with Armstrong in 1998, says they can't keep up with the demand. It's called the Lance Factor, and it's having a particular effect on baby boomers turning back to bikes in their later years and buying more expensive ones. Road bikes, which sell for over $1,000 on average, account for a quarter of bike sales. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
I want to ride my bicycle.
beginning.
One of the oldest ballet companies in the world, the famed Bolshoi Ballet of Moscow, is once again touring the U.S., raising some much-needed cash while its home theater in Moscow is being repaired.
Full sport, go. Full sport, thank you.
Bolshoi means big in Russian, and the company is known for lavish spectacles. And while this tour has disappointed some critics, audiences are loving it. Last month, when the Bolshoi opened in New York, fans flocked to see ballets such as the 19th century classic Don Quixote and the Soviet warhorse Spartacus.
We have a very dark upper stage. We need some more light over there.
That's the voice of Alexey Ratmansky, the soft-spoken new artistic director of the Bolshoi, which has gone through six directors in the past decade. When the Bolshoi toured through Boston last year, here now's Lynn Menegon sat down with Ratmansky during a break in rehearsals and asked him about new directions for a 230-year-old company.
Standby lights 20. I think we're going to do a bow ride. So stand by on the house curtain.
Okay. My permission.
How old are you?
I'm 36.
Well, that's quite young. How did you get the job? You didn't even actually dance with the Bolshoi. You studied at the school.
That's right. I never danced, and it was always my dream to dance with the Bolshoi, but I was not accepted. I was not good enough, I think. I worked in Ukraine and Canada and Denmark, and then I started to choreograph, and I was doing my first full length for the Bolshoi 2 years ago when I was asked to direct the company, which I was extremely excited and didn't expect anything like that, and it took time for me to decide whether I should do that.
So here is a major company coming to you and say, we would like you to direct this. This is handed to you almost on a platter, and you took your time to decide?
It took about 2 months, because my first reaction was, of course not. I just can't. It's too huge, you know. And then I just thought that I shouldn't miss this opportunity. And it's a group of tremendously talented dancers, young dancers. And that's a dream for a choreographer to work with.
Why are you the guy to lead the company?
Well, I don't think I'm the one to answer this question. But maybe the fact that I was working in the West for about 10 years. So I have... I can see it from outside and from inside as well, because I have Russian schooling and I came from the Bolshoi school. The Bolshoi in Russian means big, and it reflects the style, because the auditorium and the stage of the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow is very big, and the dancers are used to this huge space, covering the space, jumping, doing big gestures, filling out the movements with big emotions. That's what Bolshoi style means, I think. And it has its good and bad sides as well, because sometimes it lacks sophistication and precision and, you know, these classical academical positions. But Moscow dancers do not care so much about that. They care about movements, really moving on stage.
Do you care about that?
I think it needs some correction. The style needs some correction. And the schooling needs some correction. But the most important thing is to give all these dancers, these movers, you know, the parts and the ballets that would bring the style into the future. And another thing is that the classical ballet now... Some people have doubts about the future of it, because not many choreographers use this language for new creations. So we do feel the responsibility to bring the classical ballet into the future. That's why we need to have all the big Russian classics in a rep and perform it constantly. So this is a mainstream of our plans for the future. And of course, we need new works to develop.
And one of the works you'll be performing on this tour is Romeo and Juliet, a very new version, without toe shoes, without much of a set even. A very big distinction, difference, change for the Bolshoi.
I'm very glad that we bring this production to the States, because it means a lot for us. It was very brave to make this step and to perform this ballet.
And the London critics were not exactly loving it.
No, they hated it. But the Moscow critics were very enthusiastic. But I have to say that the audience response was very similar in Moscow and London. It was very warm. Because when you see this production, it takes you. It has this direct dialogue between the people who are on stage and the audience. And it brings a younger audience to the theater, which is very important for us, I think. So bringing in these new productions and bringing in new dancers and invite some guest teachers and doing workshops with the Russian choreographers. I have a lot in mind, and I hope it will work because the dancers are anxious to move forward.
What if it doesn't go right?
It's very possible. Always have to be ready for very strange things and to
like what?
Personalities of the dancers and the principal dancers. And it's really huge company. It's 220 dancers, something like that. I do what I think is right, and I do it every day. And I know that the results will not come immediately. It will take time, and if in 3 years we see some result, I think that's a success.
Are you excited by this?
I'm very excited, yes.
So hope for the future?
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much.
Here now, Lynn Menegon spoke with Alexey Ratmansky, Artistic Director of the Bolshoi Ballet. The company performs tonight in Philadelphia. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And this reminder, in part so we can listen to more of this beautiful music. As always, we welcome your thoughts on anything you've heard on the program today. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, John Berger, and Stefano Katsonis. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deborah Becker. Our interns are Kate Goldring, Joanna Broder, and Noah Susskind. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.